Westrick and others versus Dorkin Group LLC, Stephen C. Price, Appellant's Counsel, Scott D. Helsel, Philip Carter Strother, Appellee's Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. As the clerk said, I'm Stephen Price of McCandlish & Lillard, and I have the honor to be here today representing the individual appellants. I won't list all their names, but the lead appellant is Todd Westrick. This is, of course, an appeal from the Court of Appeals of Virginia, which in turn was an appeal from the Circuit Court of Loudoun County concerning the amendment or modification, as the key word is here, of restrictive covenants on a subdivision in western Loudoun County. Here in this court, I believe that the key issue surrounds DORCON's assignment of error number one in the Court of Appeals, which is a long involved assignment of error. And I would read it because I think it's so significant to the appeal. The trial court committed reversible error by ruling that paragraph 19 of the 1981 deed, including its use of the word modified, is unambiguous, and then from that foundational premise, ruling as a matter of law that the 2020 deed's new restriction on DORCON's group lot was lawfully adopted by a supermajority vote without DORCON group's consent. The trial court committed related reversible error by not declaring that the 2020 deed is invalid and unenforceable based on the language of paragraphs 1 and 19 in the 1981 deed. The strict construction principle and other canons of construction, and Eccles' testimony about his original intent. So as your decisions have made clear, the parameters of an appeal are determined by the assignments of error. And this assignment of error did not authorize the Court of Appeals to rule as it did, because in effect what the Court of Appeals did was just a plenary examination of the restrictive covenants and then proceeded to give its take on them. This phrase, I think, is very helpful, foundational premise, because the foundational premise of DORCON's case is that paragraph 19 of the 1981 restrictive covenants is ambiguous, and therefore application of the rules of construction and consideration of extrinsic evidence lead one to conclude that the power to modify, or the modification power, is limited to merely reductions and restrictions on uses. DORCON's implicit assumption in their case, the implicit assumption is that the 2020 modification must stand unless the authority to modify can be shown to be ambiguous, thereby implicating rules of construction and the entitlement to consider extrinsic evidence.
Setting aside for a moment and not asking you to abandon in any way the default argument, essentially, the new paragraph 21 doesn't purport to erase paragraph 1.
That's correct.
Okay. And paragraph 19 says you have the ability to modify restrictions.
Right.
Is the second sentence of paragraph 1 a restriction or an affirmative grant?
I would say neither. What paragraph 1 and paragraph 10 do in the agreement is regulate use on the subdivision. And with respect to the four lots, which including lot 5 belonging to DORCON, merely says that the allowable uses on there are coextensive with the Loudoun County zoning and subdivision ordinance.
So it doesn't restrict them other than that?
Well, no, paragraph 1 doesn't, but paragraph 10 does. If you look at paragraph 10, it also says that on none of the lots can you have poultry, sodding, you can't have swine, earth removal, or quarrying. So you have to, there are other restrictions on use besides as set forth in the first paragraph of the original restrictive covenants.
Mr. Price, may I ask you this? As you know, we've held that in the common law, there's a pretty strong requirement for strict construction to either put a restriction on free use or to expand an restriction on free use. Your opening point is that they say it's clear as a bell that you can't do this, and that you say it's clear as a bell you can do this. They say it's clear as a bell you can't do this. If it's in between, if it's reasonably debatable and it's ambiguous, wouldn't the strict construction principle be applicable? And under that logic, which is what they argue, is that, you know, the word modify has to modify something that's already there.
That's right.
So that's the logic of their argument. And the question I'm asking you is, doesn't the common law presumption, pretty strict presumption, against expanding linguistically any language in a covenant, because this is not a POAA case, counsel that we go to the middle ground between the two of you? It's ambiguous. It can be read two different ways, reasonably. But the common law says we're going to put the thumb on the scale against expanding restrictions.
Well, if in fact you get there, I do not believe that the power to modify is ambiguous. And you only get to ambiguity there if, in fact, you consider rules of construction. In fact, the strict construction rule is a rule of construction.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But the word modify is, I mean, the range is pretty broad. If I were to tell, you know, my wife, I'm going to go out and buy a red 4Runner, is that okay? Oh, that's okay. Next day I come in, no, I'm going to do a blue 4Runner. Oh, that's okay, sweetheart, no big deal. And then a month later, say, I'm going to modify my decision, I'm going to buy a $300,000 Ferrari. That would not be thought of as a modification of what we've been talking about. It's a completely different thing. So the word is elastic, depending on context, it seems to me.
Well, that's in its application. The analogy I used before is the word travel. Well, travel could mean to come or to go, but that doesn't mean that the word travel is ambiguous. The question, what you're raising, is one of application, and that's part of the problem with the Dorcon's case, because to determine, if in fact you're going to try to determine, was this so excessive a change in the allowable uses that it ceased being a modification, one would have had to establish the necessary record. So you would have had to ask the trial court to say, okay, this is what the zoning ordinance allowed, and this is what the amendment takes away from what was allowed, and sit down and do an evaluation.
But I wonder if we're focusing on the wrong word, because we're focusing on the verb modify, but
right.
The verb modify is modifying a restriction. But there was no restriction on Lot 5 in the 1981 deed on this issue. How do you modify something that's not there?
Well, I think part of it is the problem is with focusing on just one provision in there and focusing on the modification, because in here it talks about we're talking about modifying the actual restrictive covenants, not just one little covenant.
Well, it literally says restrictions.
Well,
so I'm looking for a restriction on the use of Lot 5 beyond a single family dwelling.
Right. Well, what it says is that the paragraph 19 begins, well, first off, at the beginning it says, it talks about placing these restrictions the last whereas clause, it says the following restrictive covenants are hereby imposed upon the land. And then in 19 it says these restrictions shall constitute covenants, and then further on these restrictions may be modified or vacated. So it's referring to them as a group of restrictions on the property. And what this is a modification of those restrictions.
But the restriction we're talking about did not apply from the beginning to Lot 5.
Well, that is true, but that's a modification. A modification can make the restrictions on uses more stringent, or it can loosen them. But you have to look at 1 and 10, paragraph 1 and 10, because this was an effort to regulate uses on the property. But you have to know what was allowed under the zoning ordinance and establish a record. Say, look, these are the changes that were wrought by the amendment. But that wasn't done at trial. That wasn't done in the Court of Appeals. And the first time it's ever been attempted is in the appellee's brief. where they go in and pull out the zoning ordinance and purport to do a comparison of what's been changed by this.
But the zoning ordinance is properly before the court because it's referenced in the deed and it's something the court could take judicial notice of. You don't have to put it into the record, do you?
It wasn't put in the record, and it was certainly not argued at the trial court. The Mr. Dorcon, who owns Dorcon, the LLC that's the appellee in this case, said that before he bought the case, he did some due diligence and determined what the zoning was, and it appeared that he could be able to do what he wanted to do as far as having special events, weddings, and parties and things like that. But that was the only evidence as to what the zoning was at the trial.
Focused on paragraph one. And
correct.
I understand the reference to paragraph 10 regarding swine and things like
right.
that. The restrictive covenants in 1981 placed no limitation whatsoever on the use of these four lots, because it said they could do whatever Loudoun County would allow them to do.
Well, I think my reading of it is that the restrictions on those four lots were coextensive with the zoning ordinance, so that you didn't, if they were violated, that any other lot owner would have had the power or the authority to seek an injunction against a violation of it, because it violated the covenants as well as the zoning.
But those are the government restrictions. I mean, you don't need a negative covenant that says you can't violate the law.
Well, but a individual property owner cannot enforce a zoning violation. You have to file a complaint and then hope that the local government will seek to enforce it.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't add anything to say, well, you got to follow the law.
Well,
I mean, of course you got to follow the law.
I believe it does. I believe it does, Mr. Kelsey, because I believe that what this does is empower another lot owner or several lot owners to seek to enforce a violation of the covenants for those lots which were coextensive with the zoning ordinance. So they're on parallel tracks. That's my reading of paragraph one. But then, of course, then there are the restrictions in paragraph 10, which are in addition, which apply. So one has to, as I've suggested, make a record and do an evaluation, which was not done at trial. It was not argued. The whole premise of the Dorcon's case at trial was that it was under an obligation, a necessity of showing that the covenants were ambiguous, because without a finding of ambiguity, it didn't have a case. So their major effort was through a man named Alt Nichols, who'd been the subdivider of this property back 40 years ago.
Under your interpretation, if the owners of lots 5, 2, 20, 21, 22, or 23 had requested a special use permit from the Loudoun County authorities to quarry or raise pigs, would they be allowed to do that, or would paragraph 1 and paragraph 10 be an irreconcilable conflict at that point?
Irreconcilable conflict.
Well, then, isn't it definitionally ambiguous on some level?
I don't think so at all. I think it's clear that
If they're in an irreconcilable conflict, how would one give full meaning to both provisions?
Well, I mean, a basic rule of interpretation is the specific controls the general, and the paragraph 10 restrictions are specific, and one is not. So that would trump one.
But you only get, according to you, you only get to that if it's ambiguous.
No.
I thought no rules of construction are used unless we have ambiguity.
Well, but that's only dealing with construction of a specific term. What we're here talking about here is different provisions within the agreement. And finally, I'd just like to make the point which I guess is my saving argument, if you will, dealing with the alternative provision in there that allows a vote of 75% of the parcels improved with a dwelling to agree to a change in the covenants. That was the term there. In whole or in part. And of course, in the deed of amendment adopted in 2020, that was not explicitly relied upon, but that is a power that, they had. It was over 80% of the lot owners improved with dwellings had signed it. So it could be the deed of amendment could be upheld on that basis. Thank you.
Thank you, Council.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Scott Helsel, and I represent Dorkin Group, LLC. When it purchased Lot 5 on March 4, 2020, Dorkin Group relied on the fact that it was not subject to the estate owner occupational purposes restriction and could be used for any non-residential use permitted by the zoning ordinance. That reliance interest cannot be upset by paragraph 19's general and poorly drafted language. Whether paragraph 19 is unambiguously narrow or ambiguous concerning the scope of permitted change, the appellants cannot prohibit or materially restrict the non-residential use of Lot 5 without Dorkin Group's consent. The meaning of paragraph 19, and not just whether it was ambiguous or unambiguous, was properly before the Court of Appeals based on the assignment of error. I don't even think that's debatable, frankly. No one would assign error simply on the issue, the binary question of whether language is ambiguous or unambiguous, because to answer that binary question without saying anything more says nothing about what the disputed language meant. We have always contended from day one of this case that paragraph 19 does not allow a new restriction to be added to prohibit the non-residential use of Dorkin Group's lot without its consent.
Give me an example, because the language has to mean something. So what might be some examples of a modification that would be permissible?
One thing that in Mr. Price's argument, he's focused solely on the word modify. The covenant does not say you can modify a restriction with 23 lot owners. It says you can accept, modify, or vacate.
Right, it could go in your favor.
Well, no, but I think it's important. I mean, Justice Kelsey pointed out, and I agree with him, that modify is an elastic and potentially uncertain term. But I think when you interpret modify in the context of paragraph 19, you have to consider it in a neighboring with vacate and accept, okay, all of which relax exceptions. So to answer your point directly, Justice McCullough, one example of something that the requisite votes, and that's even ambiguous, but the requisite votes could do is to relax an existing restriction, no question. So for example, the 75-foot setback requirement, if a lot owner wanted to build a house 50 feet from the lot line and the requisite number of landowners agreed, that's no problem at all.
And there'd be no common law, you know, bias against that.
That would be true. I mean, it would actually be favoring the free use of land by
I'm pushing against the tide there. It's going with it.
Correct. You know, to answer your question, I mean, if modify, even though it's in the company of vacate and accept, could allow additional changes in the opposite direction to be made, they have to be minor. That's what the Supreme Court of the United States has said on two occasions, that modify refers only to minor change. It does not allow for a restriction or a prohibition or material restriction on the very use.
But if we're looking to define modify, wouldn't we look to the meaning of modify at the time these restrictions were drafted? And it did not necessarily limit it to minor.
Well, it depends on how you look at the definition. Justice Powell, generally speaking, I think it's a good practice to look to the definition as it existed at the time. But if you look at Black's Law Dictionary, the 1979 edition, it starts off by saying to alter, just without qualification. It then says to change in incidental or subordinate features, which is a very narrow understanding. It then says to enlarge. It then separates with a colon to restrict. And it may have one other provision. If you also look at other dictionaries.
So to enlarge would go against your argument, would it not?
I don't think it would, Justice Powell, because if you go to go to the MCI case from the United States Supreme Court and Justice Scalia's examination dictionary definitions of modify. The overarching thought of modification, even in 1970 or 1981, was that modify referred to a minor change. The most important definition and the most linguistically accurate definition in the Black's Law Dictionary 1979 version is to change an incidental or subordinate feature. And that's shown by the current edition of Black's Law Dictionary, which defines modify in a consistently narrow way. It's not like in the last 30 years or 50 years, the meaning of modify has changed in the lexicon. Whenever it's spoken, it means a minor change.
But in a series of restrictive covenants, how can changing one of the covenants to either allow or disallow something be incidental or subordinate? I mean, the whole point of the covenants is that. I mean, even the 75 to 50-foot setback line, that's a significant change of the very nature of the covenant. It's not subordinate to the covenant. It is the covenant.
But it is making a change to an existing covenant, an existing restriction. Here, the Court of Appeals got it right. This is a new restriction that fundamentally changes the previously unrestricted use for non-residential purposes of Lot 5.
Or anybody buying into this, if it were worded differently, if it didn't say modify, can alter, enact new, whatever, with a significant with the requisite number of votes. If you buy with that restriction in place, then you've consented to any subsequent change.
I disagree with that. Again, modify has to be...
I'm saying if we reword it.
So let's say, first
conceptually, that's possible. It could have been worded in such a way that they could have then said you can't use the lot for this purpose.
Well, let's acknowledge this up front. Paragraph 19 in the 1981 deed as a whole is not an example of good drafting. No one would hold it up as an example of good drafting. It has numerous typos. It is vague. It is ambiguous. It is contradictory in various ways. However, and I don't think this court should lend its aid.
I wonder if that's not the end of the analysis. When you're looking at a provision that's not governed by the POAA rules, that's governed entirely by English common law.
Correct.
And you're asking yourself, is the free use of property among people that are not in horizontal privity to be restricted? It's got to be so clear that we're not sitting around having an argument about it. It's got to be, oh, duh, okay, you knew this, you signed it, it's done.
Correct, absolutely. And that's not the case here. I mean, going back to your question, Justice Russell, and first of all, the court should not and cannot redraft paragraph 19. That's not its role. But let's say, as an academic exercise, that we were to redraft it, and we were to simply say, as is somewhat common in some covenants out there in Virginia, that you can amend the restrictions with a vote of 2/3. That's what the POAA says as a general default principle.
But this is not governed by that.
Well, I agree with you, but just let's say you had before you, which you don't, a covenant that simply said that. This court has never held that the power to amend permits unlimited change. In fact, in a different context, this court specifically said you should not conflate the power to amend with the power to create.
So, for sure, how could we do it outside of a statutory exception to the common law?
If I understand your question, well...
How could we do it in your case, extend the power to restrict those who are not in horizontal privity with the restrictive covenants when it's not even governed by a statute that creates an exception to the common law?
If I understand your question, I'm not...
It's a very friendly question.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
It's a very friendly question.
Odd.
Yes, I agree with you. I wanted to make sure I understood it, but I thought so. But this court has never once held that you can make any changes you want under the power to amend. In fact, I think to the contrary.
But we have held, have we not, that parties may covenant to provide for a mechanism by which some number of them may modify or terminate the restriction. So while we certainly recognize the power of the common law, haven't we held that parties can contract to modify their contracts?
But drafting is required to implement that principle, and that's where the 1981 deed fails.
But that's because your argument is there are typos in it, there are other problems with it. But if the court could read that restriction to allow a modification by a certain number of members of the landowners, why couldn't they do that?
I think there are, well, first off, it's not just the typos that the problem. It's paragraph 19 and the provisions.
Yeah, well, my question was if the court could read paragraph 19
to allow this to particular change.
Yes, yes.
If you read it to allow this particular change, and I don't think this court should read it to allow this particular change, then it might fall within the concept that you can provide a mechanism. However, Barris isn't the start of the principle, but Barris actually recognized the importance of drafting because the court held in Barris that notwithstanding the principle, the language that it was looking at was not drafted to allow a change to be made. And that is equally true here.
We don't have a contract, though. This is not a contract case. This is a real property case where there's no horizontal privity. There's no contract between Dorcon Group and Todd Westrick or anyone else.
Correct. When Dorcon Group has never consented to this restriction. And if you take what happened...
But it consented to paragraph 19.
It consented to paragraph 19 in the sense that it agreed to buy the property, but that's not a broad agreement to consent to any change to be made.
But then it comes down to can we, should we, read paragraph 19 to either allow this or not allow this.
I accept that, but paragraph 19 does not allow this. As a thought experiment, just consider that you had before you an amendment voted on by 24 lot owners to prohibit the residential use of any lot in the subdivision because...
If I read paragraph 19 to allow this, would your answer be that the common law would... Trump, paragraph 19.
So, if you read that paragraph 19 allows it and the law permits it, okay, then on the main argument that we've been discussing, my client might have a problem. But that would get you to the two alternative arguments that I've raised. Number one, the effect of this.
Can I interrupt you there for a second? Yeah. There are boundaries that the common law puts on alienation, and that we have. Dozens and dozens of columns of law that say you cannot throw a restrictive covenant on a piece of property that forever forbids alienation, that forever forbids this, forever forbids that, because it's not a contractual relationship. It's simply a vertical line of covenants from predecessors to successors. So unless I'm wrong, this court has never approved the concept of doing this outside of a statutory scheme that exempted this whole process from the English common law.
I think that's what this court held, and I'll put it in because it wasn't...
Well, more said.
Said, fair enough, in Tvardek. And absolutely, and the court's analysis in Tvardek was very detailed, very thorough, and I believe correct. This court has never permitted outside a statutory scheme a broad system of private land use control without limitation and without... that's not governed by any accountable.
Right, and if you had outright confiscation or some of these long-standing rules against alienation, that's one thing. It's another thing to say, well, you can carry on your commercial use, but now you have additional, you know, maybe it's not profitable anymore, but you can still do what you want to do, but you're going to be sharply limited, and hey, you're in a residential neighborhood.
Well, first off, this is a large lot subdivision. We're talking, this is not a conventional small lot residential subdivision. The intent was for the main lot, lot 5, to be used for agricultural purposes. It is still being used for agricultural purposes as defined by the county's zoning ordinance, which an intent to preserve Loudoun County's western part in a rural setting. So this is not some broad commercial use. And it's not a regulation of the ability to have special events. It's a restriction.
I know it's not a paper mill, but it is a commercial establishment with traffic and maybe noise and things like that.
Well, and there are zoning restrictions for all of that, regulations. I think there's an important difference, and I don't think the 2020D does that, between prohibition and regulation. It's not saying that you can't have outdoor parties only up till 10 o'clock at night. It's saying you can't have outdoor parties at all, including between 2 and 4 on a Saturday afternoon. But all the residential homeowners can have outdoor parties. I mean, there's no restriction on on that. So I do believe the 2020 deed exceeds the scope of paragraph 19. I want to briefly talk about my the two alternative arguments. I don't have time to talk about them, but I talk about them in the brief. Justice Kelsey, you mentioned a little bit about the horizontal privity issue that it is lacking here, and if the common law requires it, that's an independent ground. It also is the 2020 deed does not uniformly affect all the lots because all of the it doesn't change anything. It expands or it doesn't change the permissible uses of the lots subject to paragraph 1. It only restricts paragraph 5 and the other three lots. I see my time's up, and I'd ask the court to affirm and remand so a final order can be entered and recorded to invalidate the 2020 deed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you all very much. Please call the next case.